Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left in Capital Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm well. How are you this morning?
Doing dynamite.
Dynamite, eh?
Yeah, feeling perky.
Well, have you heard about the new product from White Rock Distilleries that was announced? We got a little product announcement. They want us to carry this ridiculous thing. Volta, for $19.99, a 750-milliliter bottle, is an energy vodka. That's right. I said it's an energy vodka made with imported Italian vodka and infused with caffeine, guarana, yerba mate, and ginseng. It's 35% alcohol by volume, and it's packaged in a tall black matte bottle with a silver Volta logo.
Volta. To add voltage.
Okay. Why are you putting energy drinks in my vodka? And if you are putting energy drinks in my vodka, why do I need imported Italian vodka? And
imported Italian caffeine with guarana from Gulf of Mexico.
Rahway.
With ginseng from the Far East.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
Now, you've been in the spirits business a long time.
Long time, right?
20-something years?
20-something years.
Have you ever heard anyone say, you know what I love about Italian beverages? Those Italian vodkas are so good. Have you?
Yeah, I have a question for you.
Have you ever heard anybody say that?
I have a question for you.
What?
Have you ever been in a bar and someone say, you know, I was thinking about a martini, but I always get so sleepy when I have a martini.
I've actually gotten sleepy when I have a martini.
Should I? Do you have any kind of martini that won't make me sleepy?
Okay, why are you putting drugs in your cocktails? Well, I mean, have a cup of coffee. Have an Irish coffee. Okay.
This kind of stuff, it amazes me that it hits the marketplace.
It amazes me that it does well. I'm not saying these guys may do very, very well. The Red Bull in cocktails is common.
Is all the rage. That's basically what they're saying. They're saying, we'll put your Red Bull in. Don't forget about the Red Bull stuff. Just drink the vodka. Start from there, and you can forget about. Because, actually, Red Bull tastes bad. So.
Well, the thing is, it's... Okay, cocktails are about, you know, cocktails have a history. Cocktails are a sensual experience. Cocktails are, and Red Bull is fakey, fake, 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 fake.
Yes.
It's tang.
Yeah, it's
worse than
it's
tang.
It's bad tang.
Anyway, so we have this coming
in my
out
opinion,
now.
Red Bull, don't sue me. I just think that I don't like Red Bull.
They're concentrating their marketing efforts in trendy bars and nightclubs in 11 markets. You know, I was fairly trendy as a young person, but I was doing the cool trends, you know? I don't know, either retro or...
Yeah, define trendy.
Here's one for younger folks. Fizzy fruit. It hopes to bubble and tickle kids' appetite for fruit. Fizzy fruit is a brand name of whole grapes or slices of apples or pineapples that are carbonated in a secret process with the same carbon dioxide that's in soft drinks, but no added sugar. So they take a piece of fruit... And they carbonate it, so when you bite it, it bubbles in your mouth like soda.
Have some apple cider.
No, but no pieces of fruit. This is fruit that you bite into.
And it's carbonated.
And it's carbonated. It's carbonated inside the grape.
I don't want that.
Well, you don't have to have it, but I don't mind it. I actually would love to go try it.
As a kid, and I'm going to tell you something about myself as a kid.
Yeah.
I hated carbonated things.
Really?
I wouldn't drink anything that was carbonated. If my parents gave me a soda, I would stir it and stir it and stir it until all the bubbles came out.
You're a freak.
I'm not a freak.
You know why you're a freak? You know why this is a little freaky? We've never talked about this.
Yeah.
My fiance,
yeah.
Jennifer, nothing carbonated. Hates it. Doesn't
I
understand why
it.
Anybody would
when
drink
When I was
carbonated.
A kid, I hated it.
Her whole family. They drink flat
I
stuff.
Hated carbonated things. I still drink tea mostly is my beverage of choice. Even iced tea or hot tea is my beverage of choice. I still carbonated things, champagne. I'm sorry, champagne would be the exception of the of things that I like that are really carbonated.
You're so highbrow.
But usually I prefer things not carbonated.
Well, then don't buy fizzy fruit.
I shan't.
Okay. But here, and this is in an article from USA Today. Food scientist Stephen Witherly, our friend, who's going to come and do a dinner at our restaurant.
Absolutely, in April.
He's a food scientist who has done a lot of work on the neurology of why.
Why do we like certain why foods? Do we like why things? Are certain things appealing to
his
us?
Book, he has a book out called Why Humans Like Junk Food. Mm-hmm. And actually he's going to come to the restaurant in the spring, and we're going to do a dinner based on all the different principles in the book. It's really cool. But back to my story. Food scientist Stephen Witherly predicts of fizzy fruit that kids may like it so much that the overall fruit consumption by kids could actually rise. He does warn, though, that the consumption of non-fizzed fruit may decrease.
So is there anything to the science? Is there anything in there? I mean, I realize it's USA Today, so it probably might not have anything in it. But
no, what they're saying is there's no added sugar. They just add carbonation.
How do you add carbonation to an apple?
It's a secret process.
By secretness.
By the secret.
See, thing. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't like my food to have secret processes.
You know what? What he's saying is all that gets added is CO2, and I think that's kind of cool. And if it gets my kid to eat fruit instead of a candy bar, I'll take it. And a fruit roll-up, everybody, is not
has
fruit.
Nothing to do with fruit, right? Except it says fruit first.
Yeah, well, there's some fruit in there, but there's a lot of candy
it's
as
mostly
well.
Roll-up, okay?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I want to turn the conversation back. Something amusing occurred to me when Dr. Witherly said, you know, fizzy fruit may increase the overall fruit consumption, but the consumption of non-fizzed fruit may decrease. I always remember one quote that I had in a newspaper article that they asked me about someone who'd left an organization that I was involved with, and I didn't really care for the person, and I thought that they should have left. and I didn't know that they retired, and so the newspaper called me up and they said, well, what do you think about this person? What do you think about the news that this person's leaving this prestigious organization? And I said to them,
and I know the person you're talking about, and he was kind of leaving in a little bit of a cloud.
Yeah, there's some untoward behavior that caused his leaving that the newspaper didn't know about. And I didn't want to say anything mean. What the heck? I'm not going to jump on it.
Right.
So I said, you know, any time a person leaves a community, its numbers are diminished. And much to my surprise, that quote was in the newspaper.
I remember that was, they printed it.
It was in the newspaper that
I thought,
and attributed to me.
Did they not understand that you were saying nothing? Did they not get that?
Well, the rest of my statement would have been, anytime someone leaves a community, its numbers are decreased, unless somebody else comes in. In which case, its numbers are
decreased. And if two people come in, it goes up one. And then, you know, if two people come in and two people leave, then it's the same again. And
oh, my goodness. Anyway, Stephen Witherly, great guy. And the book, you should pick it up. You can find it on our website, Why Humans Like Junk Food. Really good. He wasn't the guy I was talking about, by the way. That was
Can I give you a goofy stat that I got out of restaurants and institutions?
Yeah.
5% of consumers admit they have swiped a coworker's lunch from an office fridge.
That's why you should dine out in restaurants when you go to lunch.
You know what I want to do?
Find those guys?
No. I want to leave my lunch in the fridge, and I want to put a fizzy apple in there and not tell anybody. Just see who takes it and goes, hey,
that's fine. You know,
what's going on here?
I have to say something that is amusing about working in a radio station now, as we've, you know, had a change in career in the last couple of years, and we work in a radio station every day. I come in and there's the refrigerator here.
Right.
And
like the staff refrigerator.
Yeah, we don't. And in the restaurants, we don't have a staff refrigerator.
Right, because we feed everybody when you get there, right. And if you want to order food at the end of your shift, you can order food at
and
the end of your
no
shift.
And there's no unauthorized eating. You know, it's like you can eat before your shift. We eat at family meal together, and then it's over, and we eat. And I got to say something else.
Yeah.
We eat better food.
Yes, there's no doubt about it.
I mean, we in the restaurant in general eat better than most offices.
Well, processed food is, you know, the fridge here is
sure, because you got to be able to keep it, and we make food all together as a family, and that's why we call it family meal. I have to tell you. I've been in restaurants my whole life. I didn't really think it through that people come to work and they put stuff in the office refrigerator and then they microwave it at lunch.
I eat more potato chips here than the entire rest of my life combined.
Yeah, we don't have a vending machine at the restaurant either. I understand why people don't eat quite as well when they're in this sort of environment. All right, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15. Everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick.
And today we welcome to the show Ben Kinmont. He's one of the United States' top dealers in rare and antique books on the topic of gastronomy. He's also a conceptual artist and an author, and he joins us today to talk about rare books on gastronomy.
Ben, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You know, I actually love to go to garage sales, and I remember there was a university around here that sold off a lot of the old books in the library, and I like to collect old cookbooks and cocktail books. But then I've read so much about your really wonderful rare book collection. Whatever prompted you, I don't know what prompts me to need to read these things. I find them fascinating. What prompted you to look for rare books in this particular field?
Well, it had to do with two forces, really. On one side, it had to do with just my natural interest in books, things about food and wine. My mother had written a cookbook, and I grew up in Sonoma, and food and wine, as you can probably imagine, was often discussed. But it also had to do with just I had worked in the rare book trade before for someone who specialized in medicine and science, and I realized from working with him that there was nobody in the United States really dealing with the pre-1800 food books. So I felt like there was a real need for it in the field.
Now, let's talk philosophically for a moment. I agree with you, and I think it's fascinating. But why is there a need for it? Who's attracted to this, and what do we gain as a society, and what do individual collectors gain from looking at these books?
Well, the first thing I think that's of importance that a dealer can get involved in is a dealer basically, if he or she is doing what they should be doing, they come in and they look at some material. They will, and through their efforts, are going to increase the value of that material. So they're going to come in and by using bibliographical tools and by doing research on individual authors or subjects, they can come in and start to say, well, these books are important. These ones aren't so important. As objects, these books are more complete and of greater importance and need to be preserved. The way our culture works, things simply do not get preserved if they don't attain value. The libraries don't retain them. The institutions, the museums don't retain them unless they have some value. And if they aren't retained, then the historians and the scholars who are doing research on a given period or a given subject don't have the material from which to base their research. So in a weird sense, the bookseller can actually be participating in the generation of history, I would say.
But, you know, in this day and age, we can retain the facts of a book. We can put it, you know, in 20 years ago, we put it on microfiche. Now we just put it on the Internet. We can retain the facts of the book. But there's something about having and holding that a book in your hand that's different than looking at your computer monitor.
No, absolutely. I mean, and also, let's not forget that these modes of reproduction frequently have flaws. I did a project on something at one point where I needed to have a full-page image from a sheet of the New York Times from, I think it was 1968, and the people who shot the picture of that sheet of the Times, the University of Michigan archiving or microfilm company, they had the camera slightly askew, and they lost the entire gutter of text. And I spent 6 months trying to get an image of that full sheet, and it was already lost. So these methods are not foolproof.
Well, and you know, it's I think it's interesting when you talk about collecting, because we talk about people who collecting wine often comes up, and wine is different because wine is a consumable, and there comes a point where a wine's collector value and historical value becomes worth more than what it would ever be worth to drink. And you know, of course, the way to take it's like if you ate the book, you know what I mean? It doesn't. It's a different set of it's a different sort of paradigm with wine. And I'm not a big fan of wine collecting for collecting's sake. I always say collect stamps because there is a value to collecting these stamps because in collecting it, you do preserve it. What do we learn from the kinds of books that you preserve?
Well, you see a lot of different things. I mean, for example, the current fashion that some people attribute to Alice Waters of an interest in goods and that are local and the whole issue of marketing and paying attention to seasonal food, this sort of perhaps a kind of a, I view it a little bit as a reaction to the globalization of the food market that she got involved in, that's certainly around where I live, is very, very influential. That if when you begin to look at the older cookbooks, you begin to see that that this is sort of a cyclical thing, that many of the earlier cookbooks give marketing recommendations and, in fact, will even structure themselves according to the month of the year as to what kind of recipes you should be expected to produce and where you should find the foods that you're going to have in your recipes. So I think that these are some of the things that you can see from these cookbooks, and I think you can learn new things from that. Another one that always interests me is that, for example, today we think of, through the global market, that we have flavors and tastes and types of food available that they never had before, and therefore we have a broader taste palette, so to speak, available at any given time. Interestingly, however, if you look at the 17th and 18th century cookbooks, you begin to see different types of birds, for example, that were eaten back then. You can look at an 18th century French cookbook and maybe see as many as 60 different types of recipes for as many as 60 different types of birds. And part of the issue is these birds, for example, maybe are feeding on fish from the ocean, and therefore would to us have a fishy taste to them. But back then, it was just one of the possible flavors.
Sure,
and we
basically eat two different kinds of birds.
Hey, we need to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment with Ben Kinmont. He's one of the United States' top dealers in rare and antique books on gastronomy. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:25.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light.
Vogue magazine calls Jackie Naylor the new voice of jazz. We call her family. Jackie has 6 critically acclaimed albums to her credit, including the brand new Smashed for the Holidays. From the Wall Street Journal to New York Magazine to the Village Voice, the praise is universal. The Restaurant Guys present Jackie Naylor in a Champagne New Year's Eve concert at the Crossroads Theater in New Brunswick. Champagne at intermission provided by the extraordinary Lenobe family of champagnes. Dine before or after the show at one of our restaurants right next door. The beautiful new Heldrich Hotel across the street has preferred room rates for our guests, so you don't even have to drive. Spend New Year's Eve with champagne, jazz, great food, and the Restaurant Guys. For tickets, menus, hotel rates, or more information, it's 732-828-4444 or restaurantguysradio.com. Spend New Year's Eve with us.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, stage left and Captain Lombardi. We're talking with Ben Kinmont, one of the top book dealers in the United States in rare and antique books on the topic of gastronomy. Ben, you were talking before the break about how we think of this obsession with eating locally and eating seasonally as a current phenomenon, yet it goes back to some of the earliest, especially American cookbooks. I remember we did a dinner in 1996 for the 200th anniversary of the Emilian Simmons cookbook, which was the first American cookbook we know of. And in that cookbook, she spends a lot of time talking about how to get your vegetables and how to be seasonal and how to have things locally and don't buy stuff from too far away because it's not going to be fresh.
But in the 1700s, you had to do that, didn't you?
Yeah, I think so, but I think that partly, yeah, the markets were much more local, and I think also the degree to which the books covered these marketing issues also had to do with the audience, who the book was intended for. So if you go to the really early cookbooks, if you go to the 16th century, 15th century books, what begins to happen is the cookbooks were actually written for professional chefs. They were not written, and they were written for men. You don't even begin to see cookbooks written for women until the 18th century. And then in the 18th century, when you begin to see them, what they are is they're usually cookbooks which were written for the woman of the household to oversee the male chef in the kitchen and make sure that he was doing what he was supposed to be doing. Not actually for her to sit there and cook from. That's the bulk of the cookbook.
Sounds a lot like my wife.
Oh my. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk more with Ben Kinmont. Hinmont about some antique cookbooks, and there's some interesting stuff out there that I think you might want to learn about. And who knows, maybe we can get Ben to come to New Brunswick and do his own antique cookbook roadshow. We'll work on it on the break. We'll be back after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with The Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Ben Kinmont is one of the United States' top dealers in rare and antique books on the topic of gastronomy. He's also an author himself, and he joins us today to talk about his antique book business, specifically having to do with food and wine. You know, so many of, in this cocktail revolution that's being driven today, the cocktails is an art that was sort of invented in America, went through sort of a dark period where it migrated to Europe during Prohibition, of course, but also there were under-the-counter cocktails here. And then it's come back, and it sort of hit the dark period of the 50s, 60s, and 70s especially. And what I'm finding among our friends, the best cocktailians in the world, Dale DeGroff, Audrey Saunders, Jim Meehan, Ted Haig, Gary Regan, all these guys, I remember when Dale, who's the godfather of the American cocktail, of the contemporary resurgence of the American cocktail, brought me into his office at the Rainbow Room for the first time in 1992, and he had a collection of old cocktail books, and that's where he resurrected, and then Ted Haig and Tony Abuganim and all these guys have sort of resurrected these contemporary cocktails to be able to reinterpret them.
He needed those references.
Isn't that part of the value of having these old books available? Because, you know, you say that, you know, a book dealer preserves a book by, you know, giving it value and therefore it's preserved. Why these books almost went out of existence is because no one valued them. And then Dale began to value them. And now, you know, A Gentleman's Companion is de rigueur in anyone serious cocktailian's bookshelf. And all these books have become relevant again. And that information wasn't lost.
No, it's true. I mean, thankfully, there are some restaurateurs and chefs out there who are not just looking at the current recipes and at the current ingredients and the current trends, and are actually looking back into earlier recipes to try and get some inspiration for new combinations and new types of food to serve. It's interesting because for me, with the chefs, I really, of course, do everything I can to try and encourage them and help them build up their collections according to their interests. Though it tends to be that amongst the chefs and restaurateurs in the United States, it tends to be those that were European-born that are more inclined towards buying the earlier books.
Now, who is it? Who is the audience for books? Who is dealing and buying and selling and collecting these old books in which you deal?
I sell a lot to institutions. I sell to private people who grew up in a household where food was a big deal. Sometimes, as I said, chefs and restaurateurs. The institutions are becoming increasingly important, partly because there's a great deal of interest amongst graduate students, especially if they're looking at social history or material culture, and they're wanting to understand what people ate and what foods were available at a given time.
Some of these books have become very, very valuable. I think some of our audience may not realize the cost of some of these books out there. What might someone find a very rare but important recipe book?
Well, probably my average book is somewhere between $2,000 and $3,000.
So what kind of books have you found? I mean, I think people are really curious to what kind of books inspire this much interest and care.
Well, I mean, one particular love of mine is an early food monograph. If you try to find, like I once realized that a book that I had by a guy named Ramagan from 1560 called Von Amaraten, which was published in Germany, a small thing. It's only about 6 inches tall by about 3 inches wide. After doing some research, it became clear that this was the first book ever published on spices.
Wow.
I have right now a book by a guy named Massonio from 1527, and it's published in Italy, and it's in contemporary vellum, and it's the first monograph ever published on salads, and it's over 400 pages just devoted to recipes for salads.
I think it's fascinating when you talk about things like, and you talk about that old book about spices. I mean, right. You know, let's remember all the cultural implication of spices. It was responsible for dozens of wars. It was responsible for increases in navigational ability of Europeans. It was responsible for the foundation and the crumbling of empires and kingdoms. So the implications go beyond just, you know, what's yummy, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, and you have... And in the early cookbooks, they're never strictly a cookbook. They always give some information about what season to find the item in. They give information about the health properties usually. If you're a person with chef's and chef's disposition, you're not supposed to have saffron, for example. And so the books have a lot of modes of entrance, in a sense. So people who are interested in the history of medicine are interested in them. Women's studies are interested in them. People are interested in economic history. People who are interested in strictly culinary history. They all have different ways to come into these early books.
I think a particularly interesting one for me, though, is the spices, because that's so easily demonstrable to people how the choices of what, you know, your average Europeans ate at home. I mean, if average Europeans said, spices, I don't care about them one way or the other, there would have been no spice trade. There would have been no Dutch East India Company. It would have the face of history would be completely different.
Yeah, cumin, I could take it or leave it.
Yeah. Now, with the books that come into your possession, how do you find them? Is it a sort of, you know, Francis goes to the Far Hills rummage sale and buys a couple of books for 25
cents?
Funny,
that's exactly where I was thinking about finding the old books.
I do go to the Far Hills rummage sale.
And find old...
The Far Hills rummage sale is a big rummage sale that they have here in New Jersey, put on by the Visiting Nurses Association of a very wealthy town in the area. And I used to make a beeline for the bookstore because hardcovers were 50 cents and paperbacks were a quarter.
Well... My modus operandi as a dealer is that I depend on people like you guys to do that, and then to then contact me when you find your better books.
Okay, so I'm not
out of garage sales. I'm buying books at small provincial auctions in Europe, Christie's, Sotheby's, from private people. I'm buying collections from individuals who maybe have inherited them or have them. And to be truthful, I mean, for me, for example, one of the largest cookbook collections ever formed in this century or the 20th century was by a guy named Rolf Dietmar, and he formed a collection of in excess of 30,000 cookbooks in Germany, and it was auctioned off. And to give you an idea of how particular I am in my choice of that collection, there were probably only 120 books I was interested in, and after viewing them and checking for completeness, there was probably only 60 I was interested in, and I probably bought 40 of them.
Now, do you ever have, though, the antique roadshow moment where the person contacts you and they don't have no idea the treasure they hold in their hands?
Sometimes, but not that often, not to the degree that I've seen on the roadshow.
And when they do you pay them $11 for the book and then sell it for $9,000?
On their way. But usually by the time they've come to me, they've realized that the thing has some value and some importance. And I have to say that with the internet and the number of the databases for auction records and so on, it's pretty unusual for somebody to not realize that they have something of value. It's always the other way, though. I frequently get calls from people who will say, "Oh, I have this book which was given to me or to my mother, by her mother, and so on, and been handed down." And it's sort of the same story as with the family Bible, where I just want to say it will have much more value to staying in your family than it will in the market.
Oh, that's so kind of you. That's very nice. Well, it's funny when you want to say,
Well, your great-great-grandmother had terrible taste. It's been doing the damn thing.
She bought the wrong edition.
Exactly.
Didn't take care of it, and there's pages missing. Throw the damn thing away.
And it's splattered with food.
When we come back, I would think that a gastronomy book might be more valuable if you were a cultural anthropologist if it was actually splattered with some of the food. Don't you think?
It depends on whose flop it is.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, in an era
George Washington's, perhaps it's of interest.
There you are. Well, or in an era of DNA testing, you could see, you know, how accurate the person cooking was to the recipe. All right, we'll be back in just a moment with Ben Kinlot. He's a rare book dealer dealing exclusively in the topic of gastronomy. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:45.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 US patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we're having a discussion with Ben Kinmont. He is one of the top dealers in the United States of rare and antique books on the basic topic of gastronomy. Now, when people find an old book, or when you come across an old book, you made reference before the break to how complete it is and what kind of condition it's in. How important is that? Is it like a baseball card? Does it need to be in like top
right,
condition?
Right, make sure the corners aren't frayed.
Yeah,
it's in terms of its value, its monetary value, it's of huge importance. Mm-hmm. I can have, let's talk about Brillat Savarin, the author of the Le Jus de Goût, which was published in 1826, and there were 500 copies printed. And this book has basically been in print ever since. It's been published, you know, reprinted in many different languages. If you have the first edition of Brillat Savarin and it's in a normal contemporary binding, nothing special, nothing particularly wrong with it, it's worth about $4,000, maybe $5,000. If you have a copy in a spectacularly nice binding, red Morocco, that's of the period and it's very clean, it could be worth about $8,000. If you have a copy which is in the original wrappers, which is how it was actually issued, and it's been untrimmed, then it's worth about $10,000 to $12,000.
Now, how many of those, for example, would there be extant and known in the world?
Well, the only way you ever know that is if there's a census done. And those are only done in extremely rare cases, like the Copernicus' first book on planetary motion. That Copernicus, there's been a census done. Of course, on Gutenberg's Bible, there's been a census. But on gastronomy, to my knowledge, no one's ever done it. I would venture to guess, if I just made a stab at it, I would venture to guess that in the first edition of Brillat Savarin, I would guess that there's at least 50 copies, if you include institutional copies as well as copies in private hands. It's not the rarest of books, but it is one of course, a sort of cornerstone for any important collection of gastronomy.
Now, when you have these books come into your possession and you're a conduit to the final collectors, how are these books preserved? I mean, obviously they've lasted a long time. Many of them must be very fragile. How are they both used and preserved, or do they need to just simply not be used in order to be preserved?
No, quite the contrary. They're far better made than any book we get today, unless we're out buying fine press books. So these books will outlast anything that any of us have bought in the last 30 years. The paper has much less acid. The binding has a much better binding structure. So they're very durable. I mean, the things, books do not like humidity or moisture. So if your fire sprinklers go off in your house, that's a bad thing. If you live in, you know, humid New York City in the summer, that's not enough to be a problem. The only time that you really have to be careful with them is you have to look at the binding. And if the binding is particularly dry or fragile, then you have to be careful that when you open it, you don't let it open more than, let's say, 90 degrees.
Wow. Well, okay, so this is sort of a... This is one of those questions that, you know, people say they like to come on the Restaurant Guys because we ask sort of insightful questions. This is what we call a throwaway question. We don't allow anyone to suggest this, but I really have to ask it in this case. Do you have, like, a favorite book that you found and you're like, oh, my God, that's so cool?
And I can't bear to part with it.
Well, that's interesting. This is actually a really deep question in the field of gastronomy in particular, because many of the dealers that are out there began as collectors and then became dealers to pay for their collecting.
It's the crack story
It's a lot like how Francis and I are supporting our wine habit.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. But for me, actually, that's a conflict of interest. I kind of came to it from medicine and science and into gastronomy, and the problem for me with that way of working is the best books that I get would never go to my customers. They go to my own private collection. And my interest is in developing and growing collections, whether they be institutional or private. So I categorically do not collect in this field.
Okay, so
it's a conflict of interest.
But that being said, what was the book you came across that you were like, wow, that's awesome?
An absolutely beautiful copy of the first vernacular edition of Platina. And Platina is the first cookbook ever printed. So the first edition of Platina is undated, and it's 1473 to 75, published in Rome. The first dated edition is 1475.
Wow. And for those of you who weren't paying attention in grammar school, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. So this is a picture of European gastronomy. So
when Columbus was but a mere boy.
Well, this is an early book.
But this is, and that was an important event, too, because this is a picture of European gastronomy prior to spices from the New World.
Right. There's maybe seven or eight incunable. Incunable means books published up to 1500, which is sort of the birth of books being printed. The first book being printed was around 1452-53. So this is within the first 50 years of the birth of printing is with movable type, and there's only six or seven incunable editions of Platina, and the first vernacular one was published, of course, in Italian. And this is a very, very sexy and exciting book. I mean, there you see all of these, the typography as an object. Here's these recipes that were suddenly printed and made available to anybody who could read, and you didn't have to be able to read Latin. I mean, it's the first expansion of type of the spread of information through recipes to a broader audience ever in history. I mean, it's very exciting.
Were you tempted to try and cook any of those recipes?
You know, this is a little confession here. I am the worst person in the world at following recipes.
Really?
I am absolutely the worst. I do most of the cooking, but I do look at a lot of recipes, even the old ones, before I cook, just for combinations and possibilities. But I'm really terrible at following recipes.
All right, Ben, well, I'll tell you what. If you ever come to the East Coast, I want you to email us a recipe prior to something weird and wacky from, like, 1500, where we can still get the ingredients. We'll make the dish because we're really good at following recipes, and then we'll sit down together and have it with some wine.
Okay, you've got a date.
We'll find one of those 60 birds that are
one of the ones that are still around. Hey Ben, it was a lot of fun talking to you.
Okay, and to you guys.
Thanks, Ben.
You can find out more about Ben Kinmont on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:56. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, a stage left in Castle Lombardi Restaurants. You know, I like talking to Ben because I myself, and I know you do too, Mark, like to collect old books. And I collect them not so much to have them as objects or to trade in them, but to read them. I find it fascinating to see what people were eating in Europe and America especially, and especially in restaurant culture.
Ben, you know, he specializes in some really, really special, really, really old books, you know, predate 1850. That's the kind of books that he specializes in, books that there are 30 of, books that there are 50 of, books that there are 4 of. But you don't need to collect books like that to be interested in this. Francis and I have a collection of books back from the 20s and 30s here in the United States especially, and they give you a lot of perspective as to what was happening in the United States culturally, gastronomically, as far as what was going on with cocktails. There's a lot of perspective that you can gain about what was happening historically in that time.
Well,
from those books.
Everything from The Gentleman's Companion to Fine Cookery and also to Wine, which is sort of an interesting book about those two topics, which gives you an idea of what sort of the self-described bon vivant mm-hmm. was doing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's interesting even to talk about restaurants, even if they don't have recipes. Mm-hmm. So there's a book I have called Where to Dine in 39.
And it gives some of the restaurant menus. It was
right, but it also talks to you about, it's a restaurant review book. It's the Zagat Survey of New York City, 1939.
Actually, you got that book at the Far Hills Bourbon Sale, didn't you?
No, I didn't. A person gave it to me when one of the local colleges was selling off their old books.
Great.
They bought it for me. That's right. But Where to Dine in 39, you look at the state of restaurants in New York. Well, then I have an Esquire cookbook from 1961 that makes reference to some of those same topics, and you see how the culture's changed completely. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed this hour. I'm Francis Schock.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
You are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12 noon.